everyone, and welcome to minute 166 of season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today on a very, very special episode is, and I'm honored to have, C.O. Bauer. As my main guest. He is a World War II veteran who fought in Normandy, and we're going to hear all about his stories today. And along with CO, I also have Christian Johnson Taylor, who, as many of you probably will remember, she was on a few weeks ago. You know, she's an award-winning documentary director, and we're going to talk about her film also. I mean, we touched upon it a few weeks ago, but we'll go deeper into it this time, because you know it also is a movie that features CO. So we're gonna have a lot of fun today. So I want to welcome you both to this episode.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. I must say I don't think I've ever spoken to somebody who's you know past the century mark. So you know this is really truly an honor for me. To have done that.
It's tough to get here.
It's easy for you to say.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, you got to be careful.
That's now, true. We do need to say that he is 101. We haven't even mentioned that.
Right.
And he's very close to 102.
That's right.
All right.
Another 2 months, I'll be
there. Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah. So you literally are twice as old as I am, since I turned 51 back in January.
Yeah, well, you got to be careful.
I'll do my best. We also know
that he eliminate all hazardous activities.
You mean like fighting in Normandy?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, you did that when you were younger, so you know. So I remember hearing something recently that someone said that that's the reason why wars are fought by the young young people, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't we start off with a general question? I mean, obviously, Christian, we've already talked about this, but Theo, have you ever watched the movie Saving Private Ryan?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
More than
once, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Great. And you, what are your feelings of a movie like that? Do you think it? I mean, I know that you weren't on the beach itself during that attack, which, you know, I'm sure was harrowing for everyone who was there. But, you know, what is your opinion of how they depicted the soldiers, the work, everything that they had to do in Normandy? You know, did it bring back memories, good or bad?
As far as memories are concerned, I have memories, and probably the reason I watch movies like that, because I can associate with them. Mm-hmm. Every movie is different, of course.
Yes, and of course.
Of course, they're based on a story, so the movie has to attract attention from the public, and so it has to be such that the public will get the story.
Yeah, of course.
So from that standpoint, you know, it's not that realistic, except that it's pretty much there.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, you know, for a mission like what occurred in Saving Private Ryan there, I imagine, you know, that it wouldn't be that big a deal, you know, to the troops that had it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that got it. And since it was, so... From a story purpose, you know, it's enhanced.
Correct.
What I'm to say.
Of course, but did the battle scenes remind you of what really happened there, or?
I think the battle scenes were good. You know, they were pretty enhanced. More than would occur normally, because there was, among other things, there was no during, say, I participated in attacks where there was artillery involved, and what wasn't the freedom to be moving like was portrayed in Saving Private Ryan.
Right. Okay.
I'd be somewhat skeptical, and in that they did move quite as much, because as I recall from the movie, and I would be skeptical that they held very many theoretical discussions,
right?
like you have in a movie. There's just not time for that, and the people involved, their lives are at risk, and so they're not going to be discussing theory about what happened. So
right. That
has to be in there for the movie.
Right. It's true.
Yeah,
it's very
yeah.
true. 100%. You're right about that.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us your story?
My story?
Yeah.
Well, my story, of course, is that I landed in Normandy some 100 days after D-Day with the 95th Division, Company I.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, we did not have combat. The fighting was up past Paris at the time. And we camped there, the whole division. And the division is about 15,000 men.
Mm-hmm.
For 3 or 4 weeks, while we waited to, the Allies overran their supply, and so for a period of 4 and 6 weeks there, they were out of gas and out of shells and everything past Paris. So there was no need for us on the front line until they resumed the offensive. And so we camped there and kind of marched around, and I even played football. We played softball. In fact, I played my last football game I could ever play there, because I was wounded, up when we got on the front line and attack up at Metz, France, near the German border. So we did that. And I have been back there to where we camped last year, the 80th anniversary of liberation, and Christian remembers it, right? And I actually was taken to by the French to where a battle occurred. Battle occurred, which they said was where we came. Our rifle company camped. I'm a bit skeptical of that. I looking around, nothing looked familiar, but the battle.
Well, 80 years have passed. The geography does change a little bit.
The hedgerows, I don't think, change that much. There's cattle in the fields. And I was able to do what I call the pump handle dance by a manure pile. I did it. By a manure pile in the hedgerow field, small field, cows in the pasture too.
Oh, wow.
So I did that symbolically, because I'm from a rural county, and I grew up as a farmer until I went in the military at age 19. And so symbolically, I did the pump handle dance, which I did to jumping up and down the pump handle, because back in the 40s, we didn't have power, and you got your water to drink and your water for your livestock by jumping up and down the pump on the pump for an hour or two every day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so even the Mennonites and they won't do that anymore here in the USA. So we, but in order
so why
to
was
break,
it a dance?
In order to break the monotony,
Yeah.
I wound up imagining that I was dancing with the pretty girls at a square dance, and jumped up and down doing what I call a square dance shuffle.
Very nice.
And singing a little ditty, which I'll sing one verse of it to you because there's
sure, I'd love to hear
music.
It.
And this is what my grandpa said they did, what my grandfather Bauer said they did in Iowa, where he grew up. They, if there was no violin or no music, they sang these little ditties. But the one I like was pretty good, was Rats in the Sugar Bowl. Or that this is one a little bit mixed up. Rats in the Sugar Bowl, I think it was really ants for my grandfather. Two by two, rats in the sugar bowl. Two by two, rats in the sugar bowl. Two by two, skip to the loo, my darling. And then another good one is Little Red Wagon Painted Blue. Little Red Wagon Painted Blue. Little Red Wagon Painted Blue. Skip to the loo, my darling. So I did that. That kept you warm in the winter and got water for the cattle.
Did the other guys in your unit also dance around?
No. Well, I wasn't doing it for them.
No, obviously not. But if you were doing it, then maybe it caught on.
I didn't do it there. I do the pump handle dance. Finally, kind of to entertain people and keep their attention now. But I would demonstrate it to people, and I demonstrate it now every chance I get. So I'm doing it for you. You learned a history lesson.
Right. There you go. Very
you
true.
Learned a history lesson.
Can you tell Rob, one of the stories I love is when you landed on Omaha Beach in 44 and you walked off the beach and up the cliff. Talk about that, because you have a very special experience during that time.
Yes, I did, Christian. And I seem to be the only one in my 200-man rifle company that noticed it. By the way, I was a ground pounder, a private first-class rifleman.
Okay.
That's the most dangerous job in the military.
Yeah, I'm familiar. I was a rifleman too.
Special General George Patton's Third Army.
He said he was a rifleman too. Did you hear that?
Is that right? No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Not in America.
No.
America or in the Israeli Army?
In the Israeli Army.
Okay.
Yeah, but I retired a sergeant.
Yeah. So I'm kind of glad to know that.
Well, yeah. I know, but thankfully I don't have battle experience, which I'm happy.
To go back to the story, we landed, we came across from Britain on a British ship, and we landed at Omaha Beach, and I wondered for a long time. I told the guys, of our rifle company, I can't remember climbing down cargo nets. Well, finally one of them said, listen to me, and said, well, we didn't. We were able to land just through the side of the ship. We were able to get on an LCT, probably landing craft. Troops or
landing craft transport, isn't it?
Yeah, and we landed on what I think were termed the Phoenix, which were those concrete piers towed across from Britain and then sunk after the on Omaha. Anyway, we landed on those. Then our rifle company walk single file up a path over the shore dune from Omaha inland to camp 3 or 4 miles. We just walked So I'm the only one, and I went to a lot of reunions of our rifle company and a lot of 95th Division reunions annually. So I went to them, and nobody remembered this little sign about ground level that had been placed there. Basically, what it said was, and I've not got a verbatim, but up this path has passed the finest of America's manhood. It's difficult for me to repeat that without tearing up.
Yeah, I can see.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you for sharing, even though it's difficult.
Because division after division landed there at Omaha and went up that path.
Yeah.
We were 100 days, but they'd been coming up over that path, single file. We passed our Browning automatic rifle down the line to help the Browning automatic, the BAR man, mm-hmm. to help them. Yeah. We did that because that's heavy, and we riflemen passed it up and down the line. For that reason, that's how I remember,
wow.
that sign. Also, we've been back exactly there. Carloads of guys from our rifle company, we went back to Normandy, commencing in 1987, and we agreed that we were at the location where we at the path, which is now a blacktop. You can drive down there now.
Okay.
But I for symbolism, I did the pump handle dance there too. And I'm looking at my niece Kim across the table here. She saw me do it and took a picture of it. Yeah. So the pump dance. Yeah.
How many places around the world have you done the pump handle?
Every continent except Antarctica.
Okay. That's amazing.
I've not been to Antarctica. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you still got time. You can make arrangements.
I think I'd pass.
Although he is going back to France in about 3 months. We're going to go back for Normandy. So that's going to be one last trip to France, I think.
Yeah,
it's actually just in a few days from now, because this show is airing, right at the beginning of June. So,
okay.
Right.
Well, yeah, we're going. Actually, we're going May 28th
through June 11th. Okay, so you're already there, because today's June 3rd.
Yep. So we'll be there, and in fact, on June 3rd, today, when people are listening to this, we're going to be in the town of Carentan, visiting school children there.
Oh, wow.
And he will be sharing the same story. And it's going to be a very special day because the children really, really love meeting these veterans. They can't wait to take pictures and get autographs. And for them, it's such an incredible, special thing. So,
yeah, they want to touch us.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah, they want to touch
us. How's your French?
The French people have.
No, how is your French? Do you speak French?
No, no. No, no. And I know better than to try to speak French in France.
Okay, they makes sense.
They know more English than we know French. In fact, we don't sound like Frenchmen if we try.
True.
Yeah. Very true.
Yeah.
Now, you're holding, you're talking about Up the Hills Past the Finest American Manhood. You're holding a sign here.
Yeah.
And a lot of these men are some of those finest American manhood. So tell them about this.
Yeah, well, will this picture show?
For me, it's just audio, but on Christian's site.
For you, it's just audio. Yeah. Well, I'm holding the picture of our rifle company. And I'm sitting in the front row because I was on KP, Kitchen Police.
Mm-hmm.
They were all lined up to do it. And so the cooks and the breakers and the kitchen police, you know, who do the pots and pans and all the dirty work, we're squeezed in the front row.
Okay.
Front two.
I always thought that as a kid, I always thought that KP meant cutting potatoes, because whenever you see in a movie or TV show or a cartoon or something like that, when someone's got KP, you know,
that's what I did. Potatoes. You do it in the Israeli army too?
Of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Well, no.
Well, everyone's got to eat.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to eat. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Christian, I think, wants me to tell you that this rifle company, there's 200 men, kind of hit a buzzsaw several times. And so in this picture, about one out of every three was lost their lives.
Wow.
And we agreed finally we could identify remember when we got together, we passed the photos around, because there was 30 or so men. We didn't know who they were.
Oh, wow.
We couldn't remember who they were. You know, they were listed, but we just didn't know who they were. But of this, we know who was killed in the company and, the role and we confirmed that about 60 men lost their lives, and almost all of them were wounded, and during the 5 months that our rifle company was in combat, or at least in Europe. We went into combat in the late October and went through until the company went through until the end of the war. But for me, November 8, 1944 was my last day. And that's when we attack, when General Patton's Third Army attacked to liberate the city of Metz, the mm-hmm. fortress city of Metz. And so, right. Which occurred, which took about, took about 2 weeks. Liberation, I think the fifth Army Division did the victory parade, although our 95th Infantry Division was first to enter enter the city of Metz and capture the German headquarters at what was known as the Kaserne. Mm-hmm. By then, I was already wounded and in the hospital, in the Army hospital.
Do you want to retell the story of what happened to you, or is that too difficult to discuss?
It's not difficult. I've told it a lot of times. It's history, so
it's history, but it's personal history. So sometimes.
Yeah. Well, as long as you brought up the subject. A lot of veterans will not talk.
Correct.
They vary from veteran to veteran, but I will. I always did, and because I thought people needed to hear it. I more think it's my duty to speak. That's the reason I'm talking to you.
Right. Of course. What's your opinion as to why many veterans didn't want to speak about it? There are even stories of veterans who didn't talk to their families about it. And, they only found out after either they passed or much later in life, of the heroics of things that they did while they were, fighting in either Europe or in the Pacific. And, what do you think the reason is that they say that the people of the men of the greatest generation didn't want to tell their tales. They wanted to keep it to themselves.
Well, I'd say there are multiple reasons depending on the individual. Some of them, traumatic, they may not have remembered.
Okay.
That would be one thing. The other thing that we veterans ran into when we came back to the States, it occurred for me. The other thing we ran into was that the people didn't really want to listen. And that's still true today here in the USA. When we started to talk about it, in a very short time, the thing that I ran into was that they would mention one of their relatives or somebody, and they've been over there for a long time, and they've never been hit, but they don't listen. They wouldn't listen to you. Mm-hmm. So I think in general, they just after a while, they just shut up and just didn't talk. So that's still true today.
Okay.
In the movie, still true today. In a couple minutes, that's about all you can tell. Their eyes are glazed over, and they're talking, thinking about something else, and do not listen. So if they're not listening, you're not going to talk. Well, think you just realize, well, they're not listening. I might just, well, they want to talk about something else.
Okay. Understandable.
I'll bet you you find the same thing yourself.
Of course I do. Yeah.
Yeah. You find the same thing yourself back in Israel, I'm sure.
Yeah, of course. There are some people who talk about things and some people who won't talk about things, for sure. Obviously, the situation's a little different, but yeah.
Yeah. By the way, I understand you're in America. There, have you got that? Anyway, in my instance, I would talk, but after 40 years, the veterans in the picture that I couldn't show you to 1968, we decided to hold rifle company reunions in different cities and annual reunions. And for a veteran, that is therapy.
Yeah, I've heard
the other veterans.
Stories from.
I'm sure you find that out yourself. Realize
yeah,
that.
I've actually heard stories about Easy Company. You know, the men from Band of Brothers, that they
right,
would do that also.
Right. You know. Right. Yeah. By the way, that was a pretty good movie. Pretty realistic. There was some things to pick up in that. By the way. When they walked into the bulge, you know, they didn't they came in trucks and walked in. They didn't parachute in,
right?
And but there was one of the guys that had I picked it up, and I don't think most people did. One of the guys climbing on a truck, the replacement 101st man.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of acting as though the other guy that had just joined him was a rookie. Well, he jumped in Normandy,
right?
You know, and you probably realized from your own experience that you know, if you show up at a unit as a replacement, the old boys are going to regard you as a rookie.
That's right, you know? For sure.
And you're not even able to tell them. You know, I've been in the Army quite a while, maybe longer than you might be. So, you would have that occur. But anyway, you know, that was a good movie, and then it brought them in there, and strategically, I think it was pretty accurate, because that was did happen, and you know, for me, one of the things people will ask me, you know, well, did you fight in the bulge? And you know what I say? No, I was already wounded and in the hospital. So I was lucky.
Well, based on what I've heard, yes, I would agree with that.
I was lucky, but you do that, you know. So, but anyway, I'm kind of losing the thread, but you you the therapy of getting together with your buddies, then you pass around what happened, and you learn always every reunion you would learn something more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, you wound up getting the replacements that came in, and the guys that wound up going through till the end of the war. And by the way, not very many men in that picture got through till the end of the war. A few of them, and some of them were wounded and came back.
Right.
So you learned from them. I feel the same way when I'm thinking a lot of times about what happened to I Company during combat. I wish we had spent more time reminiscing and asking questions of each other, rather than kind of whooping it up. Yeah, which is human nature.
Yeah, you know? For sure. So yes, you were going to tell us the story of what happened to you. How you got wounded.
I was in Mazières-les-Metz, which is kind of Mazierres, and that's kind of on the outskirts of the city of Metz, Metz, and so near the German border, about a half hour away and from the German border. And it's along the Moselle River, Moselle, and after the Red Ball Express had halted and they'd got enough gas and shells up, then General Patton could resume the offensive. And so really, I was hit on the and they had backed up to Metz and used Metz as a city of Metz. It's surrounded by forts, some 30 or so. You know, some of them old, but some of them were, you know, quite modern. They were French forts,
mm-hmm.
and part of the Maginot Line. And so these forts then were to deter Germany, but then they were turned against us. Those of them that in the line, those of them in the enemy's defense line, which they'd thrown up to defend in France. To keep the army out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we went up online. We replaced the 95th Division, who had entered Mazières and had been able to clear the town. And it wasn't very big, 3,000-4,000 maybe, you know, my mm-hmm. estimate. And so, for 10 days to 2 weeks, we patrolled around and had to do it at night to find out what the situation was, to find out where the minefields were, and find out if we could where their line was, their line. So basically, when I was wounded, we had a 10 to 15 minute artillery barrage on a medieval chateau, which is a strong point, with a minefield strung in front of it, and smooth wire concertina wire strung along the front line. And so, as a medieval chateau, has a history back to the, you know, mid 1900s, not 1900s, or mid century,
mm-hmm.
or 500 or more years ago. And so we had this artillery barrage, and then we went. And we were ordered to do it at after dark. And by Patton's headquarters. So it was a strategic thing. And it took me 50 years to find out for sure what the strategy was, because our officers did not want to attack at night, and you really shouldn't do it, especially in a situation like we had there. So our battalion was to attack. We were on the left side of the road down to Metz. It's north of Metz, and there was a slag pile on the other side. There was a slag pile from ore plant. So that was high. That was the Germans' observation point, because it's flat around there. And so basically we moved out okay. And we moved out okay. And by the way, I have a book here, which I've got it in it. So you probably should get a copy of it somehow. Maybe Christian can send you one or something. First thing I did was fall in a shell hole from earlier fighting.
Oh, wow.
And I was carrying the bazooka. I wasn't a bazooka man, but I wasn't very well trained in it. But when the replacement lieutenant, it was a replacement lieutenant already, who'd been, because we'd lost our my first longtime lieutenant, we'd lost him, and five or six other guys. When he came, he just came and said, somebody ought to take this. Well, nobody would volunteer, but I did, because I thought, Jesus, we're leaving. We better get it out there. we better take it. So that kept me behind a little bit. And so the first guys to run into anything, I think, ran into probably a machine gun crew that were in front of the German main line of resistance. Mm-hmm. So there was fighting there, which basically the first scout, which is my buddy Steve Bodner of Carteret, New Jersey, he was in that first encounter, and his leg was literally blown off, you know, by machine gun fire. Had to be amputated. And then they moved on to the chateau. We knew the line really was at the chateau and both sides of it, so that we'd already been out there and got them to. Well, I was on the scouting party that got them to open up, so we got to know where the machine guns roughly were. So, but anyway, when I got out of the hole, finally, it was slippery. It was deep, 5 or 6 feet deep. And when I finally got out of it, I was all alone. And then I had to move on out and catch up with my squad. And so when I got up, my squad sergeant was cutting the concertina wire, cutting so we could go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the first man through. He just said to me, see if you can get through here, and I did. And then the two guys that had the ammunition for the bazooka, they came through after me, and they said, of course, it's dark. You've already lost men, and in the dark, You know, it's hard to keep contact.
Correct.
At all. Yeah. So so I just said to them, they said, what do we do? I said, well, we're supposed to go left around it, around the chateau, and so go left and lay down till some more come through. I don't know whether there's many more through, still thinking about it now, whether there's any much of any more through to come through. But anyway, they did that, and just as that, then it'd be what amounts to a flare came out. It was a flare that probably might have been pre-programmed to fall on the wire for artillery purposes.
Right.
So it literally fell right where and blazed up right where Kellogg and Ahern, and almost simultaneously there was an explosion, which wounded me and killed those two guys. I never crossed over to see them because they made no sound and they just about had to be gone. Yeah. So, and of course I confirmed that when I got eventually later that they both had been killed. No, because so that's basically my story there of being wounded. But you know,
and where were you wounded?
And I had shrapnel of some probably 30-40. A lot of it was just small chunks, but you know, that were superficial. But then I had a wound on my left temple, which had nothing went through. It was
that's good.
Nothing went through into the body cavity, and so and my eardrum was perforated from the explosion, so I could hardly hear. I'm about like I could hardly hear today because I've losing my hearing. I have to ask you, repeat that. But so anyway, I put up a call, for help. And the assistant squad leader, a guy named Garrigan, answered me. He was the only one that answered, mainly because most of the men were wounded.
Oh, wow.
But he answered, I can't come over and help because I'm wounded and got to go back. And so he did. That left me alone inside the German lines. Pretty well known I was in a bad situation. And Christian knows that I remember where minute, second, second by second what I thought, because I believe I said, I'm Christian. I thank God I didn't think you'd do this to me. Well, talk about a sin, that's your find a fault with your maker.
Right.
And so, and even at that time, I realized that because basically I saved myself by remembering, that God helps them that help themselves.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so I wound up deciding I had a bad wound on my left leg, which I didn't know it at the time, but it caused me a partial drop foot.
Mm-hmm.
The nerve was cut to lift my foot. And so, but I crawled back to the wire and stopped remembering. It was smooth wire, so you could just squeeze through.
Oh, wow.
Through the wire. But I remember pausing and thinking, well, geez, this is probably booby-trapped, I suppose. Here I go again. And so what the hell? I got to go. And so I crawled through, and then I crawled left to the Chateau Road, Chateau Brew Road. It was Chateau Brew. I crawled left to that, and it was a gravel, gravel street. It's a street now, you know, blacktopped out to the. So I crawled out to that, and then realized, oh, I'm not dying from shock. So I guess I could walk. So I got up then, but I immediately fell down because of that.
Because of your foot, right?
Yep. So I fell down, and then I just proceeded that way. I get up and stagger a few steps and fall down till I got to the got back to where we shoved off, which was our outpost at the edge of town, shoved off from after the artillery barrage. So when I got there, there was quite a well, there had been shells explode there, and there was it was kind of tough to get into that house, which had a good secure basement under, you know, it was damaged up above, but they had real good basements, concrete basements, which were almost pillboxes. There were concrete floors.
Oh, wow.
You know, they had them. I think maybe it was part of the Maginot Line, you know, way to go, way to do things, have houses with, you know, in the line itself that were, that once it was, they'd be damaged up above, but there'd be a, you could be in the basements, you know, troops or people. So anyway, I ran into this guy named Tony Barron, Darren, who hadn't gone. They were in the reserve platoon because he challenged me, and I gave the password back. And then I asked him for help. Well, he wouldn't help me. So I proceeded to tell him what a son of a bitch he was. And I do a lot of good swear words because we farmed with horses, you know, on the farm, and I really know how to swear. So, but
it's important.
And he had the company runner with him, or his platoon runner with him, a guy named Ed Steele. And he explained to me, well, the attack has failed. I'm going out to find Sergeant Skelton, the first platoon sergeant, and bring him back. In the dark, he was. So you asked me why people wouldn't talk earlier. You know, I didn't see Steele because I never saw Steele again because he was killed. But I did see Tony, Darren, and so at a reunion some 45 to 50 years after, you know, after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tony didn't seem to remember anything. No, you know, that's me remembering, but Tony wouldn't even talk about it. I don't remember anything, he said. Well, it evidently was trauma, because what he did was going out through the dark. He stepped on a bouncing Betty,
oh,
blew part of his foot off, and it killed Steele. It did.
Oh, wow.
So I remember that, but Tony didn't want to talk. I don't remember. He did.
So did you forgive him, or did you still call him a son of a bitch?
Huh?
Did you forgive him, or did you call him a son of a bitch?
Did you forgive him? Did you forgive him? You talked to him about when you cussed him out, didn't you?
I asked him, well, you remember me cussing you out? No, I don't remember. I don't remember a thing, you know. So, and I believe him.
Okay.
Well, I didn't really forgive him, but what I did was forgave Steele, and I didn't know, you know, where Steele was buried. But Steele is buried overseas, where General Patton is buried.
And, oh, wow.
In Luxembourg.
Luxembourg. He's buried there. I didn't know it, but when we rifle guys started going over to, and you didn't hear that, we started in 1987, a carload of us going over to find out where we were and follow where I Company went. In fact, we even went to behind the Iron Curtain two or three times because my foxhole buddy Steve Bodner had relatives in Krakow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so had relatives in Krakow, so we went there, which is a great experience. I can talk all day and all night about that.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, next time, yeah. But anyway, we went, of course, naturally, to go to General Patton's, pay respects to him. We did. And so we went there, and, you know, we were surprised to find out, you know, that they didn't bury him row on row. So many people came that they buried him separate where people could come and not tread down the, you know, find them. They buried out away from the regular graves. You probably knew that.
Okay. Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, but randomly we just started walking, you know, through the looking. And the next thing I knew, I was looking at Steele's cross. So I forgave him.
Okay. You know? It's important.
I forgave him. And then I repeated it last year. We went when we were there last spring, or last in November, we went back there, and I deliberately went on purpose to Steele's grave once and spoke a little bit about it. I think you weren't there, Christian.
Mm-hmm. Not in
Christian
Luxembourg.
Wasn't there, no. So I did that.
But you forgave him. I don't think we said. When you were coming back, you ran into Steele going in, and he just didn't help you.
No,
right?
Darren.
What happened?
Darren didn't. Darren was a sergeant.
And what did Steele do?
He wouldn't help, but Steele caught part of it. So I did it to both of them.
To both of them, okay.
Yeah, naturally. Okay. I was talking. After that, then with no help, I had to get down and crawl through that stuff, and I crawled in, and I got in the house then. And I'll tell you, if the Germans had wanted to attack right then, they would have blown right through us, just like that, I'd say. Because,
good thing they didn't know.
yeah. Well, our mortars were, I don't know about the artillery, but our company mortars were, operating and firing on. So they would be discouraged from that.
Right.
You know,
sure.
They were, yeah. Anyway, I got in the house and I got in the house. Well, again, nobody to help me. There was the guy or two that was there, they weren't going to help me. They were going to be vigilant. And so I just wanted to get down cellar, down the stairs, down in the basement, because the platoon aid man was there. And he was tending to, you know, 8 or 10 wounded guys down there in the basement. And so I laid on the floor once again and cussed until finally a heavy weapons platoon officer showed up, and they'd been firing, overhead fire. They'd been firing with water-cooled machine guns. They'd fired during the attack, and they weren't firing anymore. And so he helped me down to the down the cellar, and there then I just laid there hoping for somebody to help me. And a guy named Burns from Chicago, you're from Chicago, yeah. That's one plus. he came over, and I couldn't see that he was very seriously wounded. But I couldn't see that he was. He came over and asked me if I'd taken my wound tablets. I said, no, I lost them. And so we had wound tablets. And say, well, you can have mine. You need them more than I do.
Oh, wow.
he said. Yeah. So I took him. And then, the first aid man, I think maybe he was killed later. I kind of heard that, but I'm not sure. This is things you hear.
Right.
You know, reunions. But he came over and, did what bandaging up he could on my leg and my arm. I had a bad wound on the arm too, which caused my, which cut a muscle. And so my actually hand hung down, didn't raise. It was just muscle. And three of my fingers were down, not straight, not normal. But anyway,
well, they all look fine now. I said they all look fine now. So I guess time heals all wounds.
That's right. You're seeing them. That's right. You're seeing them, and I'm seeing you. Yeah. Yeah. I can put my thumbs up. Yeah. Yeah.
And for people that are just listening, so you know, we are going to put this on the Documentary First YouTube channel.
Yeah.
So if you do want to see CO and his moving hands or the photos of iCompany, you can go to the Documentary First YouTube channel and we will put all that there and
yeah,
you can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So anyway, it was probably, I had to wait and the stretcher team from, came down, medics, stretcher team came down. Things were quieted down now, nothing happening. And at least right where we were, and so we wound up. They put me on a stretcher and started to carry me back to Battalion Aid, which was probably a half mile back in town, in one of the buildings in town. And Elijah, remember there was some incoming artillery from the Metz forts coming in. But it was going over us. It was, and I'll always remember telling the stretcher team, I wanted to get back to the battalion aid. I wanted to live. and when it would come over and it was already over, they were belatedly laying the stretcher down, taking cover. Well, I remember telling them, hey, keep going. keep going. It's already passed. So I did that. I got back there, and once again I had to wait. And there was wounded there till my turn, and on the stretcher. And so when it was my turn, or before my turn, I looked over there, and who was there but Darren? He beat me back there, Tony Darren. The guy I cussed out. And he was laying on another table. And so I don't recall that I talked to him at all, or that he would talk. But anyway, when you get to the doctor, and I even remember his name, it was Doc Herbert.
You have such a good memory. It's amazing.
I'm so impressed about that.
Well, I remember that, but what you tell me now, I can't remember it.
What do you mean?
What do you mean? You tell me the number of this house.
Oh, you forgot it?
I forgot it. the only way I could remember it is put it on the slip.
Yes, I get
it. Remind myself every once in a while.
Okay.
But I say I'm different from other people that I
remember. Yes,
that
you
was
are.
That was different. That was a life shaking experience.
Yes.
Be wounded on the line in the dark inside the German lines. Who the hell can you talk to that's done that?
That's true.
Nobody. True. No, nobody.
Wow.
So, anyway, Doc Herbert looked at me, looked at my wounds, and they actually did, cleaned them up. The first time, cleaned them up from the dirt and everything that was in it. And by the way, the first thing they do is cut your clothes off.
We're not going to go into detail.
Yeah, we're not
going to go into detail, are we?
Okay, nope.
I don't want to know all the dirty details.
And throw them away. Throw them away. So then he said, well, you're good enough. We can, you're not hurt bad enough. Well, he said, you're not hurt very bad. Well, I didn't believe that. Well, I was hurt quite bad. But we can give you a sedative. So they did. So they did. They gave me that. Then I had to wait to be taken back to the field hospital, which was several miles back of the fighting, to the field hospital. And then the field hospital, that's where you'd get good attention, your first real medical attention. But on the way there, I was on a Jeep, and I always tell people that they wondered, about you're riding a Jeep in World War II. I said, infantrymen had only two ways to get a ride in a Jeep.
If they were injured?
To be injured or killed.
Right.
Only two. Maybe it's the same way in the Israeli army. I don't know.
Thankfully, I haven't experienced either of those, so I couldn't tell you.
Well, but you probably talk to people, so.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I haven't talked to anybody who was killed.
You get stories about what happens. Yeah. That's where you learn things.
That is true.
Where you learn things about the real war.
Anyway, but, for sure.
What happened. So anyway, I was laying on the upper stretcher. They put two on, one low and one high. Well, I was just laying, looking up, but being kind of sedated, kind of halfway semi-dreaming, why, I thought I was looking down the road. So I was hallucinating that the machine gun fire was going across at stretcher height.
Mm. Oh, wow.
But it didn't, being sedated, didn't seem to bother me. I just kind of steeled myself. Well, that's it. And I had did that two, three times before I realized, that's me. I'm just imagining that, that's me. So the first thing in the hospital I got, I was sedated enough that I woke up sometime early in the morning. And the first thing that happened to me was that a lieutenant colonel came down the line carrying a Purple Heart. And I, for a couple of beds before me, he awarded the Purple Heart to the guy laying there. And one of them, I'll always remember, he, you're mad when you're wounded.
Yeah.
I was mad, and this guy was mad.
You're mad, why?
Because you're wounded.
Yeah. And?
I even missed telling you how mad I was. I was mad that I laid there, goddamn Roosevelt, goddamn Hitler, goddamn.
You're mad
Miss
at everybody.
Liddy. God damn everybody, you're bad. and that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You can be bad.
That's good, right.
You're in good shape. So I did that. And when he got to me, but this guy gave the lieutenant colonel, what are you doing here? You should be on the front line. He did. Well, I'm well disciplined enough, that wasn't right to be doing that, But when he got to me, then I didn't do that. I was respectful and said, you're awarded the Purple Heart, and you're awarded the Purple Heart, and I know you. I know that you can't. That you can't keep it with you, so it'll be put in your effects, and you'll get it later. It'll come to you. Well, I got it later when I got back to USA.
Mm-hmm.
Which took how long? How long?
Well, I spent time in the hospital, and I didn't get back to USA till the first or second week of January 1945.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And you know what I got in my stuff? All of my clothes. I even had a camera, but no film. You couldn't buy film back then. It's all gone to war, you know. And so I got my Purple Heart, minus my clothes, minus my camera, minus almost everything except my pocketbook, which I still have. Maybe Kim has got it. Minus the invasion currency.
Oh, wow.
How much, and
the pictures of my family that I had. That's all I got back from France.
So you didn't have your pictures of your family? They weren't in there?
They were in there.
They were in there. And yeah. Your invasion money was in there?
No, the invasion money was not. Yeah.
And so how much invasion money did they give you in the beginning? Do you remember?
Beats the hell out of me.
And did you ever spend any of it?
No place to spend.
Right, that's what I thought.
Exactly.
Yeah, out in the woods or...
It's an emergency bus fare, you know.
Yeah. Well, it was francs, of course, yeah. And it yeah. wasn't normal francs. It was printed here in the USA, and I don't know how they handle that. I imagine they...
I imagine they
exchanged. They probably... The U.S. government was probably literally given... money to the French government. I
know what happened. So after, if you were to buy bread, let's say with the invasion money,
yeah.
okay, you gave it to a baker.
Yeah.
And so the baker had all this invasion money.
Yeah.
When the Marshall Plan came in, let's say, and they're starting yeah. to get the economy back up and running, the baker would take the invasion money to the, you know, the people that were, you know, the, what is it called? The sustainment people that were trying to help set up the government. And they would trade that invasion money for the francs, right?
Yeah.
So that's how it works.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There you go.
Very impressive. Yeah, there you go. Wow. Thank you very much for telling that story. So now what's interesting to me is how did the two of you meet up? You know, like, I know Kristen's story about Normandy and everything like that, but I don't know how, you know, she found you or you found her or whatever it is.
Oh, Kristen found me because I'm not computer literate and I don't find much of anybody, you know.
Okay.
Not able to search, but computer is Kristen, I think, is a genius at doing computer work and all of that.
Do you actually know how I found you?
I don't, but I'll give my version and you can give yours.
All right.
And then we'll let everyone decide what's the truth.
Anyway, Christian called me and said, let me know she was coming and would I participate, you know, in being interviewed. And so I'd been interviewed by people before, but I was just overwhelmed when Kristen showed up with five people, something like that. She's a cameraman and a couple other people and somebody to do the sound and Kristen. And I had called my local paper, which is a weekly, and said, hey, I'm being interviewed. Maybe you want to have a reporter down there. So they did. So here I wound up with, I live in a bungalow style place. And I basically don't go upstairs or I don't go downstairs. And I live on the first floor all the time, live in a line from the front door to the back door.
Okay.
And that's it. That's it. Here I got all these people in the house. and here they've got the cameras and they've got the lights. They've got all this crazy stuff, the recording stuff. All in my room, plus the local reporter. So, Jesus. Anyway, and that's my first time to be actually movied, you know, videoed. My first time.
Oh,
So,
wow.
I'm amazed at how they do it. You know, they have to get the lights right, and they have to get the. And then you say, wait until we write, and then as I recall, when they were. Then they did clap, clap, or something like that. Did you?
Yeah.
Clap, clap, that we're gonna film now.
Yeah.
And then they'd film a little while, and then they'd have to move me and set me again.
We didn't move you. We moved the cameras.
They moved the cameras.
Nobody can move you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you choose to move.
So anyway, they kept going and kept going, and I kept thinking, I think they'll be done finally sometime. But about 3 hours later,
3 hours, yeah.
Well, wow. They were done. Yeah. Okay, your turn.
Okay, well, you were mostly right.
Yeah.
You were mostly right.
See, I remembered.
Now, do you know how long ago that was?
Nope.
Think about it for one.
About 4 years.
So,
has to be more.
It was actually 2018.
Is that right?
Can you believe that?
I can't, no.
Wow.
2018.
Yeah.
It's
That's what happens.
Stunning to me.
That's what happens when you're 102.
You were 95 when I met you.
Wow.
95.
Yeah.
I mean, you were a young chick. I thought you were old then. I thought you were old then, and you were just a young pup.
I know it, yeah.
So the way that it happened actually in the very beginning was a little bit different, because I had just, you know, this whole movie thing just fell in my lap. I was actually just an actress. That was all I did. I did voiceovers on radio and television, and I, you know, that's all I did until Hunter went to Normandy.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered what they did in Normandy, and I wanted to tell the American people about what they did there. And so Michelle Coupe, my co-producer, you know who she is.
Yeah.
She knew I wanted to interview veterans in the United States, but I really didn't know any.
Yeah.
So Flo Plana happened to be coming to Wheaton, Illinois, where I live. And she told me that he was coming to Cantini. It's the big red one has a museum,
yeah,
5 minutes from my house.
I think I've been to Cantini.
Have you? I live right by Cantini. And so Flo, she arranged.
I know I was.
Yeah. So Flo Plana and I met, and we went to Cantini together. We got to know each other. And right after that, he was coming to interview you, and he asked me if I wanted to come along. And so he was coming with his mother as well. So his mother and I and Flo, and then my whole team of cameraman and sound man and lighting people, like ever, we all invaded your house.
You know what? I'd forgotten Flo came.
Yeah, he was there.
And his mother. I forgot that.
Yeah. It was a very special day because, you know, what was so interesting to me is Flo did the whole interview with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the
That's
most
amazing I forgot that.
Yeah. Flo was.
Well, you said that you don't remember everything from the last decade, but you remember things from 8 decades ago. So that's fine.
Yeah, right.
So for those of you who don't know who Flo Plana is, Florent Plana is he's actually an amazing historian, but he's also a tour guide in Normandy, and he has World War II Veterans Memories. It's a tour company, and he has a, you know, all social media is World War II Veterans Memories, and he's just an amazing, amazing man, and I highly respect him. But that was the first interview I have ever watched him do, and it was just magnificent. He came fully prepared. He understood all about not only the 95th Infantry Division, not only the 377th Infantry Regiment, but he understood about I Company, and he understood about, you know, their whole movements. And he began to ask CO questions as if he was part of I Company. He knew where they had been and what they had done. And so Sio began to talk to him, and they really formed this camaraderie during the interview.
Right.
And he talked to him from the beginning of when he was born in Carson City, Michigan. And, you know, we got all the way to the end of the story, and it was masterful. And so I learned so much at that time. And what was interesting to me was that as Flo, as a Frenchman, was talking to him, I realized that was the key moment for me in my whole experience of this film, The Girl Who Wore Freedom, because I watched you in that moment change from the moment that we got there to when we left. And you probably don't remember this either, but you got happier and happier and happier.
Yeah.
And by the time we left,
yeah,
you were dancing. You were dancing.
I danced a pump handle.
No, you were just dancing. It wasn't even the pump handle. You were just dancing and you were marching for us. And you were so happy. And I thought, you know.
Well, I like to put out the word.
Well,
I'm motivated. I'm motivated by putting out the word. In fact, you know, I wind up saying to people, it's my duty.
You do.
Yeah. I've got the, you know, the military. I'm really, I don't exactly know quite the words to say, but, you know, I got the discipline of the military, and I still got it. So
yeah, he still does marches daily.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, yeah. they drill it into you, so yeah. There's no reason that you should lose that.
Yeah.
But what I saw was that as somebody cared about your story and somebody listened to you, just like Rob is doing, it made you feel cared about, and it made you feel happy.
Well,
and
it's therapy.
Yeah, it's therapy, and that is how I learned that as Americans and civilians, we can truly show gratitude to our veterans. And that's the message of my film. And it's what the French told me. And it's what I really think is important. And it's not just for veterans, actually. What I've learned is that we need to do that not only to older citizens, but I mean, it's true for anyone.
That's true.
It's true for anyone.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to put it out, you know, and hope people will listen. You need to do the same thing.
Yeah. Do you tell your story, Rob, about your service?
Have I told it or will I tell it now?
Have you told it?
Yeah, sure.
You'll talk about it?
Yeah, sure. There isn't that much to talk about, but
Your military service was compulsory, yeah?
No, actually, I volunteered.
You did. What years did you serve?
I started serving in 1993. I was in the regular army for 1 year, and then I did reserve duty for another 14 years after that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And reserve duty is basically one month a year.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I've been to Israel.
Really?
Yeah.
Me too.
I imagine I did the pump handle there, but
very possibly.
I don't quite recall it, but
well, you probably did it at the edge of the Red Sea. My guess is
I've got the
Dead Sea.
Where's the Globus? I took the Globus tour.
Well, this?
Oh, they get that brochure there. Yeah, I did this tour Globus in 1995.
Okay, I was here.
You're here?
I came in 92. I've been here since 92.
I actually did Israel and Egypt.
Ah, very nice.
Yeah, and so I and it was a good tour. Really liked it. I swam in the Dead Sea.
Well, you can't really swim in it. You floated.
I floated. Yeah, hard to get your feet down.
Correct. That's the idea.
Yeah. You know, I floated in there, and it was surprising there wasn't anybody else in there but me.
It depends on what time of year you went.
The tour group went, and But I don't know, they were on shore doing something, so I'm going to swim. So I had my swim coats, and I got on there, and I'd like to swim and see how it is. So I got in there, and they told me, don't put your head underwater, or, you know, that doesn't work. So I floated. But I'll always remember, you know, I kept thinking, maybe I'm getting too far out, you know, floating out. Maybe
I end up in Jordan.
Maybe I better put my feet down. And I'll always remember, Jesus, it's an effort to put your feet down.
That's right.
They'll say, yeah. But I went to the River Jordan, and I'm a trout fisherman, a headwater trout fisherman, brook trout, and trout. So I really, really like that, to be on the headwaters. And I looked at the Jordan. I said, geez, I believe this is a trout stream.
Yeah.
You know? probably is. I imagine they stock it. But I wasn't smart enough. I'm a guy that wings it. So I just took the tour. I'll see what happens, you know. Takes what happens. So we got to the Jordan River. I could have been baptized, but I didn't know. I hadn't G2'd to be baptized because I just didn't pay attention. But there was people from four women, ladies from Pennsylvania that paid attention. So they disappeared right away and went, you know, to have the showers and put on a robe to be baptized.
Oh, wow.
All I could do was watch, because I didn't do it. All I could do was watch, and I could stick my toe in the, my feet in the Jordan River.
Yeah.
I did that.
Well, yeah. I think the Lord probably knows in your heart that you wanted to.
Oh, I did. Yeah.
So you come back and do it now. Never too late.
Yeah.
You know, CEO, last night, I don't want us to get away from this podcast without him sharing one last thing. Last night, CEO and I were talking, and he was telling me about a time that he went back to Europe. And there was a woman who had written a speech and read it to the liberators, and he read it to me, and it was particularly meaningful to him and the other guys that were there. Would you share this with him?
Yeah. Can he see it?
Yeah, I can see it.
He can
see
it.
I can see it, but I want to hear it.
Yeah,
you want to hear it, yeah.
Yeah, and we'll put it up on the YouTube. We'll put a picture.
I don't think Christian realized the significance of this until I read it last night. We were discussing movies, the movies of the World War II movies that occurred, and the fact that for you it was a thing that you did to study them, but. In fact, I was saying, you know, that they are a story, you know, and that they have to be enhanced somewhat in order to be sold to the public, for the public to show up to them. But anyway, I said that we fought at the 50th anniversary, we veterans at Metz. We 95th were finally thanked, and it was an unusual thing, which that we were thanked. This lady, Elizabeth Gozzo, G-O-Z-Z-O, at one of the surrounding small towns around Metz. We had the small towns around Metz. They like to get into the act, kind of. They like to have you come there, and the mayor will be there, and they'll hold a ceremony and maybe bring you in for some Mirabelle, you know, some of the local spirit, and into the Hotel de Ville. Anyway, Elizabeth Gozzo, and I didn't know her at the time, got up. And we probably had, at the 50th anniversary, the most World War 95th Division veterans that ever showed up. We probably had 50 or so. So we're down to one now that shows. That's me.
Right.
But Elizabeth got up and off of a handwritten copy, read this. And I start to tear up when I start to talk about it.
That's a good one.
She finally thanked us in a way that we could understand. Just a local citizen.
Wow.
I'd been to a lot of ceremonies before, but heard authorities and mayors talk and all that. But Elizabeth did it. So I'll read it for you. Dear liberators, dear American friends, we want to give expression to our deepest gratitude to you for what you did for us in 1944. I got to put on my glasses. I'm tearing up and can't read. What you did for us in 1944. We know the terrible cost of our freedom. After a few years spent under the cruel Nazi boot, France was bloodless. French people daily lived the humiliation, the fear, the denunciations, the threat of torture, and the concentration camp. It was a nightmare. And then you came, an irresistible impulse. You appeared like a fabulous sunbeam after a terrible 4 years long night, like a blessing from God. All those young Americans sacrificed. You wrote a page in our history, and without any doubt, it is the most beautiful. You offered us the most wonderful present in the world, liberty. But at what cost? At what price? All these young Americans sacrificed in the spring of their life. All these inhuman suffering which wounded your bodies and your souls, all that you endured, rend our hearts and pain us. We are so much indebted to you, we have for you the highest respect. You are our heroes who defeated the barbarism and who saved us. You are our dear liberators. We'll never forget you. And our gratefulness for you is deep and endless. You are graven in our hearts. Thank you wholeheartedly. Thanks, GIs. God bless you all. God bless America. We love you.
Wow.
I never heard it better.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing.
It's typical French. You know, the French, they've just got it to express themselves. I guess it's because of the Roman influence in France, and I guess it is. But
I don't know.
I've talked to Elizabeth before. After that, she showed up, and she's had a stroke. I talked to her this last November. I did not long, because I was under control of circumstances, had me under going from place to place, bang bang, and I couldn't talk long, but Elizabeth, you know, was a great person. She came to the USA even, one reunion. She and her daughter did.
Oh, well.
You know, I think, too, what I've learned is that it really is not just the French, honestly. I've also seen this spirit in the people that live in Luxembourg and the people that live in the Netherlands.
Uh-huh.
And it's really when you've been oppressed, like she said, I mean, after a few years spent under the cruel Nazi boot, You know, they lived in humiliation and fear and denunciations and tortures and the concentration camps, and they lived in a nightmare. And when you live like that and someone comes to your rescue, I think that grateful spirit, they can't help but feel that way about you.
Oh, I know it.
When you see their savior come to them.
The French have passed that on. They're teaching it to their kids. Their kids know it. They want to touch the veterans, and they wanted our signature, and they just wanted, and then they would like to talk to you if you got time, if you can talk to them. But you, Kim's sitting over there. My niece is sitting across from me, listening and smiling. But when she and her husband, when I hit 80, I said, somebody better go with me. You know, I was going with the crew, but somebody better go. So Kim and Carl volunteered to go. And that's the first time Kim really understood what happened. And when she went to the cemeteries, you know, like Saint of Old, and went to the World War I cemeteries, then she really understood what had occurred, you know, in literally in my lifetime. And so she just came home and said, well, we got to take more next time. So every 5 years, we've taken the family,
wow,
you know, whoever will go. We've taken 12 to 15 people for every year since the 50th. So, and we were in Normandy and with about 18 or 19 in our family last year. We were, that term that Elizabeth used up there, you'll hear that at Metz. You'll hear French come up to you and say it. They just say, all those young Americans, they're referring to, really, to St. of Old Military Cemetery.
Yep.
And the 8 or 10,000 white markers that are there.
Right.
They're referring to. And, you know, out of my rifle company, I'm not sure how many men in my rifle company are buried there, but my first time there with my buddy Bodner, we didn't look up any names, but we just started walking and aimlessly, and we'd come across somebody out of our rifle company. And that was a moving experience to do that.
Yeah,
most of them we knew they were killed, but we didn't necessarily knew they were buried there.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow, this has been such an amazing experience for me to be able to talk to you about all this stuff, Theo. I really do appreciate you being willing to take the time to tell your story so that I can know it, and you know, all of my listeners can know the story, and that Christian can have this also for her uses on her website, and you know, also for posterity, so that we have this. You know, we now have a record of this, which is great. So thank you very much for taking the time today.
There's something else I should tell you. Communication was such before World War II that you know, we just had radio, and a lot of times we didn't have that. And so I did not know about the Pearl Harbor being bombed, because I was out on the farm and my parents were away, and I did not know about it for a full day until the newspaper came the next afternoon. Can you imagine that happening today? So
we don't have the
television instant by instant coverage that we have today, and that's hard to explain to a current generation people that they don't understand that we didn't. But in my instance, and most of our instance, I will tell you that I did not believe the atrocities that were being committed by our enemy, by because it just didn't seem reasonable to the. And I think a good share of the Americans and a good share of the Allied military troops, it's pretty well documented, were amazed, surprised when they uncovered the concentration camps.
Yeah.
Certainly our political, people, our national leaders certainly knew that, but it didn't get to the general public. And probably it may have in Europe, but here in Europe it didn't. And so I just thought I should put that out because okay. let you know it, because it is important. I did hear on tours. I did hear the word. Well, we didn't do anything. Well, in my view, we just didn't realize it. But the other thing, we didn't really have a military anyway, of consequence at all in World War II. We had to start out from scratch. I guess we had quite a lot of Navy, but we didn't have an army.
Right.
Yeah. The guys were training with wooden rifles, so.
I want to show you his army picture while we're at it. Look at this handsome guy.
Oh, wow.
And if you're just listening, again, you can go to YouTube and see his picture. We'll put it up. But yeah, pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah.
Look at you, handsome devil.
Yeah, well, there's goddamn few of us left.
That's true. Rob, we appreciate you having us on. Thank you so much for listening. I know we've taken up so much of your time today.
Every minute was worth it. No question about that.
Thank you. Well, good luck. Well, you're a veteran too, so
thank you.
Good luck to the Israeli army.
The
Allies established Israel, really.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Correct, because Palestine was a protectorate of the British.
Correct.
Correct, and I understand that. I kind of remember being surprised by that, on the movies or the news I got, being kind of surprised by that, but I really understand that we need to continue to support Israel, because they're not in a good situation where they are. I feel that we need to. We need to stop the fighting if we can, find some reasonable basis to do it, and we need to do that everywhere in the world.
That is true. Very true.
We do.
Everyone wants peace. We have
to remember that people are dying, and there are a lot of times they're innocent people, and whatever effort we can do, we need to do, and God needs to show us the way.
True.
Yeah. Very true. Very true.
That's true. Well, thank you so much.
Christian, do you want to just tell people, what your website is so that they can get in touch if they want?
I would love that. So the film is called The Girl Who Wore Freedom. You can find out more about that and watch the trailer at thegirlwhowarefreedom.com. If you're in America, you can see the film on Amazon, Apple TV, Vudu, Google, YouTube. Unfortunately, if you're in Israel or anywhere outside of the United States, it's very difficult. I don't know that you can see the film yet. But if you're a distributor anywhere else, we'd love to talk to you. My email is christian@documentaryfirst. Our production company is documentaryfirst.com. And our social media is all documentaryfirst at Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all of those things. And yeah, we'd love to hear from anyone that wants to talk to us. So if people want to write CO emails or letters, you can send them to me, Christian at Documentary First, and I will make sure that he gets them. I like to send him things from people that that want to communicate with him. So yeah. I'll be happy to do that.
All right. Yeah. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So once again, thank you both for joining me today. I will be back tomorrow with another interview. But until then, earn this.
Earn this.
Vive la France. Long live the United States of America and our free world allies.
In my solitude, you